Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce you to the music you'll be hearing at the festival this summer. For Music at Menlo's 13th season, we'll explore, with a more concentrated focus than in any previous summer, the life and work of one of history's most extraordinary musical figures, the Austrian composer Franz Schubert. In addition to ranking among history's most cherished musical voices, Schubert remains one of Western music's most fascinating and confounding figures. The only composer of the Viennese canon native to that city, Schubert represents a bridge from the classical era to the Romantic generation. Born in 1797, 12 years before the death of the father of the classical style, Joseph Haydn, Schubert lived but an ephemeral life. Beethoven, the composer whom he most revered, was 26 years his senior. Their deaths were separated by just 20 months. But what Schubert accomplished in his short life is astonishing. He enjoyed recognition in his lifetime for only a small part of his staggering output, the gradual revelation in the decades after his death of what he had done is unprecedented among the great composers. In addition to his epic contributions to the piano, chamber, and orchestral literature, his oeuvre of more than 600 lieder revolutionized the genre, transforming it into one of the Romantic era's essential art forms. And as illness forced him to confront his mortality before his 30th birthday, Schubert, who once claimed, "I have come into the world for no purpose but to compose," produced a stream of masterpieces unequaled by many composers over entire lifetimes. Nearly two centuries after his death, Schubert's place in the pantheon is secure, but his music continues unceasingly to offer new discoveries and immense rewards. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by artistic co-director Wu Han, Audio Notes author and producer Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
Schubert's transformative years of the early 1820s, during which he contracted his eventually fatal illness, were filled with artistic and personal turmoil. Yet the masterpieces flowed, and during the summer of 1825, a period of better health sent him off on a four-month holiday in beautiful Upper Austria. The music of 1825 and 1826 often brims with vibrant joy, sometimes interrupted by ominous premonitions. Opening with a set of lieder, this summer's fourth concert program, The Hopeful Years, also features Mozart's C minor viola quintet, a work that Schubert heard in the performance during this time, and from which he drew inspiration. The program concludes with Schubert's magnum opus in the string quartet genre, the quartet in G major.
A letter of 1825 from one Anton Ottenwald to Schubert's friend Joseph von Spaun noted, quote, "Of Schubert, I could tell you nothing that is new to you and to us. His works proclaim a genius for divine creation, unimpaired by the passions of an eagerly burning sensuality." This is one of numerous accounts suggesting that Schubert, the shy, diminutive composer, affectionately nicknamed Schwammerl, or Little Mushroom, by his friends, in fact led something of a double life. His friend Eduard von Bauernfeld shared his impression after Schubert's death with one of the composer's earlier biographers. Quote, "Schubert had, so to speak, a double nature, the Viennese gaiety being interwoven and ennobled by a trait of deep melancholy, inwardly a poet and outwardly a kind of hedonist." End quote. Yet another friend wrote to the composer's brother, "Schubert's body, strong as it was, succumbed to the cleavage in his souls, I would put it, of which one pressed heavenwards and the other bathed in slime." End quote. As a consequence of his apparently promiscuous lifestyle, Schubert contracted what almost certainly was syphilis in the early 1820s. As grim a diagnosis as this remains today, it practically represented a death sentence in the early 19th century. Schubert became acutely aware that his days were numbered and spent his remaining few years racing the clock to say what he needed to say with his music before his time ran out.
From February 1825 through the first half of 1826, the symptoms of Schubert's illness mercifully abated. The composer might even have allowed himself the remote hope that he had been spontaneously cured. This period of happy respite was also marked by new blossoming friendships, creative productivity, and in the spring and summer of 1825, a four-month holiday. Schubert joined the baritone Johann Vogel, with whom he had summered in northern Austria in 1819, for a similar vacation, which included a six-week stay in the idyllic lakeside village of Gmunden. It was during this period that Schubert began work on one of his most hallowed masterpieces, the Great C Major Symphony. Alongside this epic orchestral work, he likewise continued to compose in his signature genre, the Lied. The Lieder from this time included Die Allmacht, a setting of a poem by Johann Ladislaus Pirke, whom Schubert met on another stop on his extended holiday. The text and Schubert's setting reflect the composer's optimism during this brief period of good health.
Great is God the Lord, for heaven and earth proclaim his power. You hear it in the raging storm, in the loud, resounding roar of the forest storm.
Near the end of this brief period of happiness and health, in July 1826, Schubert completed three Lieder on German translations of song texts from the plays of Shakespeare. An Silvia comes from Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona.
Who is Silvia? What is she that all our swains commend her? Holy, fair, and wise is she, the heaven such grace did lend her, that she might admired be. Is she kind as she is fair? For beauty lives with kindness. Love doth to her eyes repair to help him of his blindness, and, being helped, inhabits there. Then to Silvia let us sing that Silvia is excelling. She excels each mortal thing upon the dull earth dwelling. To her let us garlands bring.
Schubert's setting cheerfully expresses the wide-eyed admiration of Shakespeare's words. Schubert's affable Ständchen, or serenade, on a passage from Shakespeare's Cymbeline follows.
Hark, hark, the lark at heaven's gate sings, and Phoebus gins arise, his steeds to water at those springs on chaliced flowers that lies, and winking merry buds begin to ope their golden eyes. With everything that pretty is, my lady sweet, arise, arise, arise.
Seine Rosse mit dem Tau der Blumenkelch.
The set concludes with Schubert's Jolly Trinklied, or Drinking Song, from Antony and Cleopatra.
Come, thou monarch of the vine, plumpy Bacchus with pink eyne, in thy fats our cares be drowned, with thy grapes our hairs be crowned, cup us till the world go round, cup us till the world go round.
Des Weins, komm mit Baume Wille Scheins. Unsere Sorten säuft ein Fass, und bei Laub uns grüne Lass. Füll uns, bis die Welt sich dreht. Füll uns, bis die Welt sich dreht.
The program continues with Mozart's string quintet in C minor, K406.
Towards the end of the 1780s, Mozart's star had begun to fade among the notoriously fickle Viennese public. The composer's expensive taste and general inability to manage money had plagued the family with constant financial difficulty, even at the height of his fame. Now, his decline in popularity further exacerbated the Mozart family's continuing hardship. Mozart's various attempts to generate income during these years included placing advertisements soliciting subscriptions for, quote, finely and correctly written, unquote, manuscript copies of three string quintets in C major, K515, G minor, K516, and C minor, K406. The last of these was a reworking of his previous serenade for winds in C minor, K388, a seeming cop-out, perhaps, by a struggling artist in desperate straits. The task, however, of adapting material originally conceived for eight wind instruments to a quintet of strings, two violins, two violas, and cello, is no straightforward exercise. And indeed, the ear quickly confirms that the work in its string quintet manifestation lacks nothing of Mozart's supreme originality, and in particular, his ingenuity in conceiving instrumental textures. The serenade's original scoring of pairs of oboes, clarinets, bassoons, and horns suggests that it was designed to serve as a festive piece for use at some civic, probably outdoor, celebration. This would seem at odds, however, with the music's gravitas, set in the stormy key of C minor and comprising musical ideas of unsmiling severity. And while Mozart's kaleidoscopic treatment of wind instruments in the original work is, of course, masterful, the work's rhetoric lends itself particularly well to the timbre of viola quintet, a genre largely developed by Mozart, and one perhaps more readily accepted by listeners, then and now, as quote-unquote serious chamber music. The first theme of the opening allegro reveals Mozart to be an irrepressible font of melodic invention, a direct forebear, in this regard, to Schubert, the following century's prince of song. Following a dour unison statement, the theme spins forth a series of short melodic utterances, each of a distinct character, but which complement one another in seamless fashion. From plaintive to aggressive to coquettish in rapid succession, before the theme's eloquent closing phrase. While we often think of Mozart's music in such terms as transcendent, a celestial foil to the corporeal force of Beethoven, the Sturm und Drang of this first movement shows that view of Mozart to be incomplete. Even the movement's secondary theme, in the more welcoming key of E-flat major, feels patently human rather than divine. Here, we might especially detect a prefiguration of the indulgent pleasures of Schubert's Lieder. The Andante second movement responds with those qualities of Mozart's music which we consider sublime. Effortless melody set to transparent harmonies and delicate featherweight textures. This is music that sits easily alongside Mozart's most inspired slow movements. The third movement, Menuetto, is the most obviously festive feature of the original serenade for winds. Yet even here, the music's character is more angular, a bit surlier, than Mozart's listeners might have expected from a wind band playing a genteel dance form. The minuet is a straightforward canon. But Mozart gets craftier for the contrasting middle section, spinning a double canon in inversion. The second violin presents the melody, taken up two measures later by the first violin, but up a fourth and inverted, or turned upside down. Two measures later, the first viola repeats the second violin melody, and the cello inverts it, down a fourth. The quintet concludes with a set of seven variations on a beguiling theme. The most affecting of these, perhaps indeed one of the most exquisite passages of the entire work, is the seventh variation, a sinewy, chromatically rich transformation of the theme. Which proceeds straight away to the suddenly good-humored major key coda.
Like much of Schubert's work, the string quartet in G major failed to receive its rightful acclaim during the composer's lifetime. Aside from a private performance on March 7, 1827, the quartet's first movement was heard in public on a program of Schubert's music on March 26, 1828. The public premiere of the entire quartet did not occur until 1850. It was published the following year. The date of that all-Schubert program is significant as it marked the first anniversary of Beethoven's death. The G major quartet completes a magnificent triptych begun 2 years earlier with the Rosamunde and Death and the Maiden quartets. This set, in a medium transformed by Beethoven's cycle of 16, resoundingly announces Schubert as that composer's heir apparent. Schubert was certainly conscious of Beethoven's Razumovsky quartets when he conceived of these three. In its sheer dramatic scale, the G major, moreover, bears some resemblance to Beethoven's Opus 130, which Schubert had heard in March 1826. For Viennese audiences to spend the first anniversary of Beethoven's death in the company of Schubert's latest chamber music and Lieder was as symbolically meaningful as it must have been orally satisfying.
For each of the major last late quartets, including the quartet Satz, if you had to string them together with one thing, it would be, of course, the songfulness, the unbelievable melody, but also the drama.
Violinist Aaron Boyd.
And I'll add, the thing that makes Schubert very interesting to me is the size of the canvas. Now, in Beethoven's case, the canvas can also be quite large. 131 is a very large canvas, and it might be that's exactly why it was attractive to Schubert on his deathbed, because he saw that there was something similar in his own aspirations. But the combination of really extended drama over 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 40, 50 minutes of this sort of thing becomes a sort of hallmark of late Schubert. It's like the Ninth Symphony, the cello quintet. All of these things get larger and larger and larger and take up larger spaces. But within the quartets themselves, there is this heightened drama, this darkness and light. And I will say, I think the most distinctly Schubertian quality is the near obsession with death. Death is a quality which, of course, is in the Death and the Maiden Quartet, but it's in all of those late works, starting really with the Quartet Satz, which is a break from all of his previous music. It's a new thing. It's a new and very serious and very mature Schubert. And the Rosamund has this quality, and even the G major. I can hardly call it G major, because it's half the time it's G major, half the time it's G minor. And it's back and forth all the time. So there is this quality of death being near all the time, either chasing him or him chasing it, but that's, for me, the most overwhelming sense.
Just as he shades the quartet's lyrical and melodic ideas with shifting harmonies, so do Schubert's instrumental textures accomplish great expressive breadth. One of the work's most breathtaking moments comes quickly, in the latter half of the first theme. The first violin utters a naive melody above awestruck tremolandi, played pianissimo in the lower strings. It's as though we have beheld, our eyes swelling with tears, something too beautiful for words. Yet Schubert captures and expresses the feeling with perfect specificity.
There's a beautiful video of the Juilliard Quartet playing the opening of the G major for Elliot Carter. And now the listeners to this and other musicians might think that Elliot Carter could have no time of day for the opening of a Schubert quartet, and yet he sits there with, as this piece starts to unfold itself, with a face of such wonder and delight and astonishment. He cannot believe what he's witnessing. When I saw this, it changed my perception of this movement. You've got one of the greatest minds in music sitting there listening to this quartet like it's a revelation. And it is a revelation. It's a revelation to all of us, every time.
These quartets hard to play.
They are monumentally difficult to play. The Schuberts are phenomenally difficult because, in their particular way, in their peculiar way, they are difficult because the material itself is so simple. For example, in the G major quartet, the second subject goes. Well, these are four or five notes. That's it. So with the rhythmic lilt and the small number of pitches, how do we shape this? How do we work with this material? It's very Mozartian, in that Mozart also, in its simplicity, poses some of the greatest challenges.
The first violin decorates the theme with quick, repeated triplets. This second theme is given a lengthy presentation and evolves restlessly before our ears, gentle at first, but soon dark and stormy. As if Schubert has inserted a short set of variations within this sonata form movement. The first violin's repeated triplet gesture goes on to power the development section, where it is shown to be close kin to the tremolando figure presented earlier.
There's a funny story about Sascha Schneider, who was the second violinist of the Budapest String Quartet, and he told people, we don't tour with the G major quartet anymore. Well, why not? So every morning after we would do that, I'd cut myself shaving. Well, and as I was young, I didn't understand what that meant. Well, it's because half the piece is tremolo, this sort of very fast movement of the right arm, making a really excited, ghostly sound. And yet to do that at the highest level, at the highest level of expression and excitement, your arm will fall off. But you have to do it because Schubert asks you to do it. So I find that Schubert is one of the composers that asks the most of the musicians. Beethoven asks the most, but Schubert's right up there with him. And for me, these quartets are individual Everests. So it's an unbelievable challenge. It's also an exhilarating experience.
Following the highly charged development section, the recapitulation returns to the material of the exposition, now transfigured. The narrative weight is unmistakable. Something momentous has taken place. The slow second movement begins with a keening cello solo. ¶¶ The mood changes dramatically with a ferocious outburst, accentuated by blustery runs in the first violin, fortissimo unison cries, and deafening silences. The opening theme is reprised twice, first in brooding B minor, then oscillating between E minor and E major. Underscoring the arrival of this final chapter of the movement, second violin and viola play the same luminous tremolandi so central to the character of the first movement. And which yield here as well to repeated triplets. The same harmonic and textural devices that imbued the noble opening movement with such nuance similarly enrich this more somber musical statement. The lithe scherzo anticipates Mendelssohn's so-called Midsummer Night's Dream style, with its breathless scurry and delicate finish. The galloping allegro assai resembles the final movement of the Death and the Maiden quartet. Its rhythmic profile is inspired by the tarantella, a traditional folk dance from the southern Italian town of Taranto, which also gives the tarantula its name. Dubious legend held that the tarantella's frenetic tempo was designed to shake the venom from a spider bite. Cast in sonata rondo form, this finale contains no fewer than 5 distinct melodic ideas, and features further major-minor harmonic contrasts to great emotive effect. Like the last movements of many of Schubert's great chamber works, including the Rosamunda and Death and the Maiden quartets, this finale may seem, on a cursory listen, an ill-fittingly light conclusion to such a penetrating work. But an attentive ear will detect as much nuance and expressive depth in this final movement as throughout the quartet's preceding 3.
It's hard for me to put myself in the frame of mind of anyone who finds fault with them, because I find them so exhilarating, so extraordinary, and such a psychological release very often from what has occurred previously to some of the slower unfoldings in the slow movements, the slower unfoldings of material in first movements, that usually these very motivically compact and repetitive last movements are, for me, a release from that tension of the previous musics. They work in a perfect way for me, as a release and as in building their own kind of frothy excitement. I find them just exhilarating. The quartets probably move me more than any other chamber music. I should say all of Schubert's chamber music, particularly from the Quartettsatz an, including the octet, the Schubert cello quintet, all of these things. They offer me some of the most human and profound utterances that we have.
Audio Notes is authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Wu Han, Patrick Castillo, and Rachel Sokolow. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts on this disc appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Schubert's G Major String Quartet, performed by the Emerson Quartet, and Abendstern, Der Wanderer, Die Allmacht, An Silvia, Ständchen, and Trinklied, performed by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau and Gerald Moore, and Wanderer Fantasy, performed by Wilhelm Kempf, appear courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Schubert's Arpeggione Sonata is performed by David Finkel and Wu Han. Mozart's String Quintet in C Minor, performed by the Nash Ensemble, appears courtesy of Hyperion Records. Schubert's An die Musik, performed by Christopherin Nomura and Derek Hahn, and Octet for Winds and Strings, performed by Anthony McGill, Dennis Godburn, William Vermeulen, Arno Sussman, Georgia Flizanis, Sin Yun Huang, Andres Diaz, and Dashun Zhang, appear courtesy of Music at Menlo Live. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.